morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties and on AM 930 in Los Angeles County. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, many of us took satisfaction in the news last week that State Senate Bill 128, the so-called physician-assisted suicide bill that has been before the state legislature for some time, was removed from the from legislative consideration, it appears, for at least the remainder of this calendar year. What happened to it? Well, the short answer is that it simply ran out of steam. It didn't gain the necessary traction in the Assembly's Health Committee and evaporated for lack of votes. That's the short answer. Here to put a bit more flesh on the matter is Tim Rosales. Tim is the spokesperson for Californians Against Assisted Suicide, which is the umbrella name for a broad coalition of diverse groups, medical, religious, civil rights, and disability rights organizations, among others, that have banded together to defeat the bill. You may recall that Tim joined us here on the show back in February to talk about the ramifications of the bill and about the coalition's opposition to it. Tim, welcome back, and congratulations on the coalition's victory on SB 128.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me again.
Well, first of all, is it a victory? The proponents of the bill say they don't have sufficient support now, but they're talking about trying again in 2016, possibly even putting it to the voters in the form of a referendum. Should we be worried about that?
Well, first, I think it's a huge setback for those who would like to see assisted suicide legalized. I don't think there's any question about that. But certainly the issue isn't over. They can bring it back legislatively. They can also put it to the voters of California. And I think, you know, those are realistic things that could occur with the issue of assisted suicide. And so moving forward, I think we can, I think, take some solace in the fact that there is not, at least at this point, the support in the assembly, the state assembly, for assisted suicide. But certainly the proponents are going to continue their campaign to see what they can do to move the issue forward in California.
Well, it looked for a while anyway as if the bill was gaining support, but it suddenly seemed to just run out of gas. In fact, the Sacramento Bee polled the members of the Assembly's Health Committee, and they found, as I recall, only four members who were actually in favor of it. Where did everybody else go and why?
Well, I think we started to see legislators begin to move against the bill as it was moving through the Senate. If you recall, in the Senate Health Committee, the only physician in the Senate, Dr. Richard Pan, who represents a portion of the Sacramento area, he abstained, which is from the vote, which is the same as not supporting the bill or opposing the bill. And I think it all started there. And you began to see this undercurrent of opposition and also questions being raised about the issue of assisted suicide as people become more familiar with the issue, and particularly, I think, legislators. You saw it when it went to the Senate Appropriations Committee. It was placed on the appropriations suspense file.
Yes.
Which that was another hiccup speed bump for the legislation. And then really when it once it moved through the Senate floor and you had all the Republicans who voted up against it, as well as Democratic Senator Tony Mendoza, who represents part of Orange County, voted in opposition. And then you had Senators Richard Pan again, and then also Senator Ben Hueso from the San Diego area that did not support the bill. You know, really the opposition in the legislature, I think, began to mount, and you really saw that kind of come to fruition when it was before the Assembly Health Committee, and the members there really having a lot of questions about the bill and the issue. The more they got to know about the issue and started to look at the issue, I think the more questions it raised in their minds, and the more opposition I think it started to get internally from members of the assembly that were looking at it.
Yeah, and the opposition wasn't necessarily technical or legal. they were openly admitting that they were having moral quandaries.
Yeah, I think they're not comfortable with the issue. I mean, I think when you look at the issue of assisted suicide, just in terms of, you know, how legislators may think about it, that's probably not the issue they went to Sacramento to work on or to, you know, make their priority. You know, they have a number of other concerns that hit home a lot closer to many of their districts, like the economy, like basic health care, other issues such as that. And in terms of assisted suicide, I think that you know, that became one that the closer they got to the issue and the more they began to look at the issue, how you implement something like that in the reality of the healthcare system that many of their constituencies operate in, I think was a very troubling prospect for these legislators.
Well, tell us a little more about the coalition that you represent. You've said that a number of the organizations in it make for strange bedfellows in a way, at least on one hand, but they've managed to accomplish their goal.
No, absolutely. I think a lot of these organizations, you know, that are part of this coalition that oppose assisted suicide, come to it from a variety of different perspectives. Some of it faith-based, some of it secular, some of it based on their professional experience, some of it based on personal experience. Many of these organizations are on the very far left side of the political spectrum. Others are on more the right side of the political spectrum. Many times, these organizations have never ever worked together on any other issue before, and they don't even agree on probably 99% of the issues that they deal with. However, on this one issue, it's unique in that it crosses the political spectrum, and it was able to and has been able to unite these very diverse organizations that check, you know, all the other political baggage that they may have at the door. And when they enter the room to work together on assisted suicide, that's the issue that they work together on towards a common goal. And it's a pretty unique thing, I think, in terms of anybody who is a political observer, pretty unique to any issue, but certainly unique to this issue of assisted suicide. And I think it's one of the things that has made this coalition a strong coalition is because of its diversity.
Well, I'd like to talk about one member of the coalition in particular here. The issue's been framed in some quarters as a fight between the proponents of the bill in one corner and the Catholic Church in the other corner. But that really isn't completely accurate, is it? It's not a monolithic issue in that way.
No, and, you know, to be honest, every time that the proponents start to, you know, hit rough waters, the first thing that they do is single out, you know, some of the faith-based, you know, opposition to assisted suicide. In this case, it's the Catholic Church.
Right.
And so when they start to do that, you know that they're in trouble, because that's the card that they always play. I think the question that I think that folks should be asking the proponents is, rather than the Catholic Church opposition or opposition from other groups, but what is it that they're doing wrong? Because they continually are losing, they're continuously losing on this issue, not only in California, but in other states that you know, across the country, like Connecticut, like Maryland, Delaware, Colorado, Nevada, states that have, you know, very moderate or even, you know, like California, Democratic leading legislatures, and they're not moving the ball forward, particularly in a year where, you know, the proponents of assisted suicide have had an enormous onslaught of favorable press, you know, everything from being on the Oprah Winfrey Show to Dr. Oz to being on the cover of People magazine.
Right.
But yet they're still not able to move this issue forward in a way that I thought that I think that they anticipated that they would be able to. And so, you know, again, I think, you know, any time that they start to try to deflect the focus from what are they doing wrong, you know, onto somebody else, it really is kind of good news for the opposition, because it means the opposition is obviously doing something right.
Well, I want to talk about another couple of groups that you mentioned to me the other day as well. You've singled out disability rights groups and oncologists, cancer doctors, for particular praise in their efforts to defeat the bill. Why is that?
Well, they make up important components of this coalition, large components of this coalition. The Oncologists Association, both Northern and Southern California, have been tremendous partners in the opposition, and these are doctors who are closest to the issue. They're facing life and death every day, and you know they understand the issue of assisted suicide probably unlike any other medical specialty, and they have been very strong and very staunch in their opposition. Also, the disability rights side, and they are amongst some of our most progressive or left-leaning partners in this coalition. But they look at it from the perspective of social justice, and also from the perspective that many times and often people who experience disability or living with serious illness are looked at as, you know, lives unworthy or somehow less worthy than people who are able-bodied. They understand that they can be, you know, steered into certain directions by a healthcare and medical system that is very cost-conscious from their perspective. And they are very expensive. You know, they have very expensive care. They have very expensive things that they need and that they require. And so they have been some of the most, the strongest opponents and allies when it comes to opposing assisted suicide. And this is not new. This has been the case for over 20 years. You know, the first time that this issue kind of came forward in California in recent memory is back in, I think, 1992 with a ballot measure that was defeated. But disability rights organizations were very prominent in that effort and have been prominent in efforts ever since.
Well, many thanks once again to our friend Tim Rosales for joining us and for bringing us up to date on the state of things in Sacramento regarding SB 128. We'll continue to keep a close eye on the issue and we'll report on any developments in the on-again, off-again story as it develops. Tim, much good luck and thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me.
When we come back, the Knights of Columbus. Please stay with us. We are back. Domestic violence is a subject that many of us would prefer to believe is rare or that it's something that happens to someone else, but the truth is much more stark. Let me give you a few statistics. One in four women, that's 25%, has experienced some form of domestic violence in her lifetime. Every 9 seconds in the U.S., a woman is assaulted or beaten. Approximately one in five female high school students reports being physically and/or sexually abused by a dating partner. On average, more than three women and one man are murdered by their intimate partners in the country every day. And finally, most intimate partner homicides occur between spouses through boyfriends and girlfriends have committed about the same number of homicides in recent years. Also, more than 900 elder abuse complaints are filed each month right here in Orange County. Mike Schaefer is with us today to talk about domestic violence, its prevalence, and what can be done about it. Mike is the Director of Risk Management and Insurance Services for the Diocese of Orange, but he's also part of a team that is conducting presentations at parishes throughout the diocese on the subject of domestic violence. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
What is the Domestic Violence Awareness Initiative, and how long has it been going on now?
The Domestic Violence Initiative Committee, has been meeting for about 2 years. We formed to address the issue of domestic violence in the church. Everyone feels that it's out there somewhere. Everybody feels that it can't touch them. But in reality, with the statistics that you just read, one in four women are being abused or have been abused.
That is an amazing statistic.
It's a horrifying statistic, and even more so in our ethnic communities, the numbers are even higher. They go up to 75% of women.
My goodness.
And these are women and men. One in 11 men are abused as well. Those folks are sitting in our pews on Sundays. As a matter of fact, that's how I got interested in domestic violence and talking to a parish business manager a number of years ago who worked in a women's shelter, in a battered women's shelter. And she said that what she found horrifying is that the women that she would deal with on a day-to-day basis who came to the shelter she would see them on Sundays with their husbands, who were the abusers, who were literally pillars of the church. So it's not just the people that stand in the back of the church, it's leaders of the church, it's anyone. And it affects everyone.
And at its core, domestic violence is about control.
It's about power and control. It's about, for example, with teen violence, it's about the abuser telling the person that is being abused who they can talk to, where they can spend their money, how do they dress, how are they going to dress, who are they going to need to avoid, how much money do they have to spend. It's all about power and abuse.
Well, how does it most often manifest itself? You've mentioned a few ways. It's not always about somebody getting punched. There are a lot of subtle things that can happen.
No, there's something called a circle of violence that talks about in the early stages, the abuser is moody, the abuser is nitpicks at the person being abused, yelling, drinking. Drinking and drugs have a great influence negatively over domestic violence, threatening, criticizing. The abused person is trying to be nurturing, trying to stay away from family and friends because it's embarrassing. They are walking on eggshells and attempting to soothe the abuser. That's the first cycle. The second cycle is where there's acute explosions, where there is hitting and choking and humiliating in front of people, in front of the kids, imprisonment, rape, verbal abuse. The victim is trying to protect themselves. They call the police. They try to calm the batterer. They try to reason with the batterer. And lastly, the honeymoon phase where the abuser is saying, honey, I'll never do this again.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I love you so much. I want to stop this. I'm going to stop it. You can trust me. And then it starts all over again with nitpicking and so on.
And the million-dollar question here, and you see this on TV and people bring it up, and it still, I think, is mystifying to some people. Why doesn't the abused person simply pick up and leave? Why don't they just get up and go? It's not that simple, is it?
It's not that simple, especially when you're talking about power and control. It's the abuser's castle. It's their house. They're not going to move. And they're going to try to make it so the person who's the victim and the children are not going to move either. They do everything they can to take away money, to keep them imprisoned in a sense. Don't talk to your family. Don't talk to your friends. They keep them very much isolated.
Well, and many of us think about domestic violence as affecting women, and of course it does to quite a degree, as we've heard. But there are others as well. It affects men. It affects children. It affects teenagers. It can affect the elderly.
Absolutely.
There are so many populations out there that can suffer.
Absolutely. And much the same signs of domestic violence that we see between a husband and wife are also seen with teens who are involved in teen violence and the elderly as well. It's a vicious cycle.
And the common denominator, I imagine, in all of them is the abuser is always in a position of power and control.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And where the church comes in, the abuser is the person who stands tall, who's the respected father or the respected parent. No one's going to question that.
Where does an abuser get the idea initially? And this may be a question that's a bit off point, but are they the type of person that was maybe a bully back in junior high or something like that? Or is it something that was ingrained in their character at a very young age and it emerges later in life as abuse?
Sure. Pat, that's a very good question. People who abuse today were usually abused as children. And they not only see that and feel that anger, it just grows in them. so that when they're in a position of power and authority, they do the same thing.
Well, obviously, the abused person is in the most need of immediate help. Now, here in the Diocese of Orange and Orange County in general, there has to be a good and growing network of places that you can go for help or people you can talk to. At the end of the broadcast here, we're going to give you a website and hopefully some more information mm-hmm. on where to go for help. But there is a good and growing network, I imagine.
There is. There's at least four battered women's shelters in Orange County. Each of those shelters have therapists and psychologists. They have people who are there to help enable the person who's being abused to get help, to get out of the situation, to figure out what they need to have to get free of the abuse that they're encountering.
Now, this is on the other side of the coin. What about the abuser? This person obviously needs help, but they are probably going to be much less willing to admit that they do.
Mm-hmm.
What's the protocol there?
Well, in the Domestic Violence Initiative, we are looking at working in several phases. The first phase that we're working in is just educating our parishioners. We're doing presentations in the parishes in the mornings and the evenings whenever we can get in front of them to explain what we've just been talking about. The second phase is to certainly do the same type of presentation for our leaders, for our clergy, for priests and deacons and parish staffs as well. Lastly, we want to train people to help develop support groups for both those who are being abused and for those who are the abusers. Support groups have worked in many other places. We feel that they can work here and will help them to stop the violence.
One last question here. How about third parties? If you suspect somebody is being abused, what can you do? Where do you go? What's your reaction?
I would suggest calling one of the domestic violence shelters and asking them that very question, and they'll be able to help. We have resources in each parish that have those phone numbers, that have some ideas of what the person, the abuser, needs to have in order to escape the abuse. The bishops wrote a letter over the last 10 years. It came out again in 2002 called When I Call for Help, a Pastoral Response to Domestic Violence Against Women. And their main three issues, their main three goals are to create parishes that are places of safety for women and children, to bring accountability to the abuser. We were just talking about that. And lastly, to either restore the relationship if that's possible. And a lot of times it's not. And in that case, to allow the person who's being abused to mourn that relationship. There were good things about it. They got married. They were dating. To mourn that and enable them to move on.
Let's give our listeners a little contact information. A great web resource is www.lifejusticepeace.org. That's lifejusticepeace.org. That will get you to the website of the Office of Life, Justice, and Peace for the Diocese of Orange. Just click on the Issues tab and select Domestic Violence. Mike Schaefer, many thanks for being with us today and for all the extremely valuable information about domestic violence and what all of us can do to recognize it and prevent it.
You're very welcome.
This is Orange County Catholic Radio, AM 1000, coming to you from the Tower of Hope on the campus of Christ Cathedral. I'm Patrick Mott, and we will be right back after this.
Come out and enjoy America's pastime with your friends and loved ones. It's Catholic Night at Angel Stadium. Root on the Angels with Bishop Van and your congregation. Then end the evening with a family-friendly movie out on the field at Angel Stadium. The movie is included in the price of your ticket. For the best prices and special seating areas, go to angels.com/Catholic Night. Be sure to put in the promo code Catholic. Hurry, the best tickets will go quickly. Go to angels.com/Catholic Night and enter Catholic. See you there.
Thank you. Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. Here with us in the studio is Dr. Ronald Knowles, the past president of the Orange County chapter of the Knights of Columbus. Many of our listeners, I'm sure, are quite familiar with the Knights, but others may know them only from seeing them in their very colorful ceremonial garb at such occasions as church dedications and other special and significant ceremonies and rites of the church. Of course, the Knights are much more than this, and Dr. Knowles is going to fill us in about that. Dr. Knowles, welcome to the show, and many thanks for coming down to the studio to chat with us today.
It's my honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, the Knights of Columbus is 133 years old this year, if my arithmetic is correct. Tell us how and why the order got started.
Our order was started by Father Michael J. McGivney, who is a Catholic parish priest at the time in Connecticut, and it was his desire to start an organization that would help especially widows and orphans of the men at that particular point in time that might have been injured or suffered death in a mine accident or industrial accident. They had nobody to help them. And so he started this in the basement of St. Mary's Church to establish the Knights of Columbus, and that was one of the first things that was to help the widows and orphans and also to bring the men closer to the church.
Well, now, the order operates under four guiding principles. They are charity, unity, fraternity, and patriotism. I'm going to ask you to put a little flesh on those principles for us. What are their particular meanings for modern Knights of Columbus?
Charity, I think, is our primary principle. Giving is the greatest virtue, as the Irish often say, and we're certainly a believer in that. And one of our main goals that we do, we have certain programs from our Supreme Office in Connecticut and from the state of California. We do things for coats for kids, foods for families. In the Diocese of Orange especially, we raise about $150,000 each year for a camp for the intellectually disabled that's put on by Catholic Charities.
That's Camp Recreation,
correct? Camp Recreation.
We just talked about that on the show last week, as a matter of fact. Yes. Please go on.
And some people call that the Tootsie Roll Drive. We stand out in front of a church and give you a Tootsie Roll and hope you'll give us a couple of dollars for the camp. And that is one of our main goals. We also are helping with Special Olympics and World Games just in about a couple of weeks in Los Angeles. That is another one of our charities that we work with. We also do a lot for the individual parishes and churches and schools. We help out a variety of the schools and whatever they might happen to need. We don't have an unlimited amount of money, but we're there to help our parish and our schools.
Well, the unity and fraternity part, I imagine, is pretty self-explanatory considering the history of the order, right?
That's correct. We tend to know that obviously if we stay united, we can accomplish more than we could if it was just one person. Fraternity basically is our friendship and our sharing with our brother knights, good times and bad times. We're always there. We are a family.
And patriotism, of course.
Patriotism is the fourth degree of the order, which I'm sure many of your listeners have seen. We're the ones with the chapeau and the sword that you see at confirmations, and we escort the bishop to many different events. And that's something. The kids think we're pirates, so they like to take pictures with us and say, gee, Dad, I got a picture of a pirate today.
Well, those outfits are unique, I think, in all fraternal organizations, and they're immediately identifiable with the order.
We are the visible arm of the order. They were patterned after 1800s naval uniforms, and it is a lot of fun. It's something, if you join the fourth degree, you don't have to be in the color corps, but it's one of the most fun things that we do. At the Christ Cathedral Assembly this year, we put on a school flag program. We went out to eight of our parish schools. We talked about how the Knights of Columbus were basically responsible for putting under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. And we talked about that and gave each of the students a flag. And it was a lot of fun. The students enjoyed it. We got a big kick out of being there with them.
Well, I think some of our listeners may not know what you mean when you say the fourth degree. Give us a little background on that.
The fourth degree was set up for patriotism, for things like getting out the vote, helping with the census, helping with veterans. We put on a picnic each year for the Veterans Hospital in Long Beach. We go out and cook our hamburgers and hot dogs and visit with the veterans and have a good time doing that as one of the things that we do for patriotism. And, of course, again, the Pledge of Allegiance.
And does it take a certain amount of time in the order in order to become a fourth degree?
Several years ago, we used to have a waiting period of time. It used to be a year from the time you first joined.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's no longer a waiting period. So somebody could become a fourth degree knight in a matter of a few months if they so desired.
Okay. Well, the KFC website describes the members of the order as, this is a quote, men of faith and men of action. Your level of personal involvement and the amount of charitable contributions remains very high, correct?
It does. We have done very well, I think, within the Diocese of Orange, the Knights of Columbus, and our various councils that are in almost every parish. Probably contribute close to $250,000 annually to Camp Recreation, for example, wheelchairs for veterans, for Perry schools, for seminarian scholarships. We support a large number of our seminarians and religious brothers and sisters that are studying for going to the priesthood and becoming a religious brother or sister.
Well, it says a lot, though, that you are not simply men of faith or not simply men of action. You are putting those two principles together and really making them work.
I think you're very correct in that. We are a faith-based organization. We are a Catholic organization. We start our meetings with a prayer. We end our meetings with a prayer. One of our mottos is we stand in solidarity with our priests and bishops. We certainly support them at every opportunity. We are here to help Bishop Bann in whatever he might ask of us. We do the best we can to support our parish priests. And again, I look at it basically in four areas. It is faith. If you join the Knights of Columbus, guaranteed you'll become a better Catholic. There's no question about that. I think it makes you a better father. I think it makes you a better husband. We're involved with family. We have a lot of family activities. We have picnics. We have, obviously, the pancake breakfast. We have our ID drives where we collect money. A lot of different family events that we have. We also have friendship, which, again, is a networking with men of like-minded values and interests. And the fourth one that I like to enjoy is fun. We're a fun organization. You join us, we're going to have fun. You don't join to go to a meeting. You don't join to listen to somebody talk to you. You join because you want to have fun. And that's what we try to do in our meetings and events. We try to have fun. We try to have fun with the family.
Well, respect for life issues, as I get it, are very important to the order. You have several culture of life programs that have been initiated by the Knights. Can you tell us a little bit about those various culture of life initiatives?
We have a very good ultrasound program that the Knights of Columbus at the Supreme Office will match 50-50 the funds raised to get an ultrasound machine for Birth Choice and for other organizations like that, so that the young lady coming in actually gets a chance to see the baby. And the statistics vary, but it's somewhere between 80% and 90% of the woman that sees the child in an ultrasound keeps the child. And that's one of the great things that we do is an ultrasound initiative. We were there at in the Walk for Life in Los Angeles. We go to San Francisco. We go to San Diego. We support those things in terms. We have a very active culture of life program within the Orange chapter. Bernie Vicious is our chairman, and he does a fantastic job for us.
Well, who can become a knight? And once they become a knight, what can they expect? What's the process like of becoming a knight? And once they're in, what is it like week to week, month to month to be a knight?
Basically, to be a Knight of Columbus, you have just a few requirements. You have to be a male 18 or older, and you have to be in a practical Catholic, someone who is union with the Holy See, with the papacy, mm-hmm. and the values of our church. And if you meet those simple qualifications, you join the Knights of Columbus. And our dues for most of the councils range anywhere from $30, $40 a year. It's not an expensive organization.
No.
And we teach you through our principles of charity, unity, fraternity, and patriotism. We teach you about the Knights of Columbus. And those are what are called our degrees, our first, second, third, and fourth degrees. First degree is charity. Second degree is unity. We teach you about doing things together. And then once you have joined, basically, a lot of men say, oh, I don't have time. I don't have time to join the Knights. I've got kids, and they're in soccer, and they're in volleyball, and they're in 55 other different things. I just don't have time.
Right.
And my response basically to them is, just pick something you'd like to have fun with. You like to cook, join us at a pancake breakfast for an hour a year. Help with the parish fiesta for a couple hours a year. Whatever you'd like to do. We do a communion breakfast where we come together at Mass. We sit together We go to communion. When we're done, we go out and have a nice brunch somewhere. Come join us with your family and do that. You can put as much or as little time as you have in it. If you're busy, maybe you only have a few hours a year. If you have more time and you want to spend a few hours a month, we can sure use you.
Well, in about the minute or so we have left, how about a little bit of contact information for some of our listeners who might be out there and might be considering joining the Knights?
One thing, they can go to our Orange Chapter website, which is OCKC.net, OCKC.net, and that will get to the chapter website. If you're interested in joining, there's information there. You can click on our membership request form, and we will be overjoyed to contact you and speak with you and give you whatever information that you need. You can reach me on that website too, and we're more than happy to explain to you the principles of our order and how much fun you can have.
Lastly, and I want to just hit this kind of quickly, we didn't touch on it right at the top more than just a couple of seconds, but you have a wonderful insurance program.
We do. We have a fantastic insurance program that's available only to members of the Knights of Columbus. It is one of the very top-ranked programs, insurance programs in the United States. It always gets fantastic reviews. Excellent program for the Knights of Columbus. You don't have to purchase the insurance, but it's a fantastic bargain if you do.
One of the highest rated in the world. And for information, once again, that is OCKC.net. Dr. Ronald Knowles, many thanks for joining us today on Orange County Catholic Radio. Once more on that contact information, OCKC.net. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Please stay with us. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. Remember that recurring line in Fiddler on the Roof that the town rabbi gets to speak whenever someone approaches him and asks whether there's a particular blessing for a particular thing, the tsar, for example? And the rabbi says with calm authority that there is a blessing for everything. Well, Catholics know this well, and we regularly ask our priest friends to bless everything from our new rosaries to our pet hamsters. But here on the phone with us today to talk about a very specific and very cool blessing that you can receive this Saturday evening, July 18th, is one of our special priest friends, Monsignor Doug Cook. Monsignor Doug is the judicial vicar in the Diocese of Orange's Office of Canonical Services, and he's also the rector of Holy Family Cathedral in Orange. All that keeps him pretty busy, as you can imagine, but he always finds some time most weeks to get under the hood of one of his own project cars or check out somebody else's. Monsignor Doug is a committed gearhead, and this Saturday at Holy Family Cathedral, he's going to get all the holy water he can find, and he's going to preside over the annual blessing of the cars. Monsignor Doug, welcome, and thanks so much for taking time to tell us about this very cool event.
Hey, thank you very much. We have a good time with it, and you described it beautifully. I'm even more excited about it now than before.
Well, it's such a great idea. I mean, who dreamed it up, and when, and why?
You know, there was one going on in the L.A. area that was really quite a huge event, and it kind of fell apart. I think they sort of outgrew their venue and just couldn't make it happen again, and that was some years ago. I'd always had a fun relationship with the Knights of Columbus and my prior parishes and here at Holy Family Cathedral too. And they've in several instances said, hey, would you be interested in helping us if we did a car show, kind of a little fundraiser? And the last 3 years I said, yeah, great, but let's make it, instead of just car show, we can do a car show any old time in Southern California. I said, let's make it a blessing of the cars and time it around the feast day of the old St. Christopher. Call it the St. Christopher Day blessing of the cars. That's how it came about. I've got some great help with the men of our parish for Catholic Men's Fellowship, who help with barbecue, chili and cornbread. There'll be drinks and dinners available, but otherwise it's a free event. The drinks and dinner are a fundraiser for our youth ministry, and it's just kind of a neat outreach to the community. We pass out a ton of flyers and hope to make it a big event.
Yeah, there's a lot more involved than just blessing of the cars. You You got food, you got drink, you got, well, there's mass.
Parking starts on the field at 3, mass at 4 if you'd like to attend. Dinners begin serving about 5, blessing about 6, and the music continues until people, as long as they want to hang around and visit it. It's a neat little show we get. We get a lot of variety, some brass era from the aughts and the teens, all really just a nice mix of people, restored cars, daily drivers, really exotic stuff. Just, an older lady who's been driving a 1970s bug since new, and she keeps it running and brings it proudly every year. So all kinds of stuff.
Well, it's a non-competitive event. You know, nobody's competing for anything. So it's really an opportunity for all these guys and women from all over the place to show up and just check out each other's rides and have a good time.
Yeah, it's a very social hobby I've found over the years, and you meet a lot of neat people, and you can always start up a conversation, you know, with that driving old Buick, and met a guy just the other day who had 1 year earlier, and we ended up talking about him and his life. For, you know, somebody comes up and asks you a question, and it's an automatic door opener. And, you know, cars are a big part of life in Southern California in the modern world, and so why not bless them? You know, there's customs of blessing the fishing fleets, for the fishermen, for plows and fields, for the farmers. So why not the cars in Southern California?
Absolutely. Well, it says here on the brochure that I have in front of me, which is a pretty terrific brochure, too. It says you're going to be giving away a pretty neat item to some of the choicer rides.
And I got a couple of them, and it's not any kind of judging or anything, but just a little way of encouraging people with a neat car or hey, happy to see you came, and here's a little expression of gratitude.
Yeah, it's
sort of thing.
It's a vintage St. Christopher Dash medal, which I imagine not a lot of cars have anymore.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
You were going to be there with your own ride, right? Which is a
54 Buick Super. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now this is the one you've been bringing to the event for the last 3 years now?
We've had it going in various forms since I got there, so 4 or 5 years. Yeah, since I got to Holy Family, 4 or 5 years now, in one form or another.
Fantastic. Well, now, you don't really have to have a hot rod or a vintage car or a custom ride to show up. It's kind of like,
if you take pride in it, if you're relying on it for your daily existence, if it's been running really lousy and could use a little help, bring it along for a blessing.
I have to read a couple of the things you have in the brochure here. It says, you take pride in it, bring it. If it's an essential part of your life, bring it. If it needs a blessing and you know those Catholics do the best, bring it. If it's dirty, wash it and then bring it. So that encompasses just about everybody.
And for the meticulous types to worry about water spots, I will be using distilled water for the blessing.
Now that is thoughtful. That is thoughtful. Now, I would warn everybody to put at least 2 or 3 coats of Meguiar's on, you know, just to make sure it beads up nicely, you know.
So there you go.
Looks good in the photographs. Well, I want to get back to something here that you touched on just a second ago. What do you tell people who wonder about why you'd want to go around blessing cars? You know, people think, well, okay, you know, you bless things that are inherently holy and in church all the time and so on. But this all comes under Catholic tradition, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the idea that the parishes in the port cities of Europe have for centuries done the blessing of the fleet. That was how people made their income. That was major economic investment for a family or a business. That was a source of livelihood and even safety for the fishermen. You know, that boat don't hold up, bad things happen. So they bless the fleet. I consider this something very, very similar. We're asking the Lord's protection on this gizmo that's a pretty major investment for gearheads like me. It's also a source of a lot of pride and enjoyment and satisfaction. It's something that you work hard to pay for and take care of. And, you know, then things are 4,000 pounds hurtling down the freeway. Just might be a good thing to have it blessed. keep people safe inside it, keep people safe outside it.
And at their best, they are things of beauty. It would not be unlike blessing a statue or a work of art.
Yeah, and you think about what happens in an automobile. You're taking your friends to a place. You're driving your family on a vacation. You're going to work. You're doing some act of kindness, you know, maybe giving somebody a ride or you're on your way to go see somebody sick. Or even just relax and enjoy the beauty of the world. Go out for a Sunday drive. Now, there's a novel idea.
or a Saturday drive.
Or a Saturday drive. And come out to the car show, to the blessing of the cars. You know, there's just a lot of good things that can happen in an automobile, and it's worth asking a blessing.
Well, you touched on this a minute ago as well, and I'd like to get a little more on it. What sort of cars can people expect to see? Do they really run the gamut from?
Yeah, we do. We do. I have a buddy who's bringing a curved dash Oldsmobile from 1903.
Whoa.
Father Troy, my associate there, is going to be bringing a 37 Oldsmobile. I'll have my 54 Buick. So we've got Brass Arrow all the way up to modern stuff. Fellow showed up last year with would you believe it or not, a hopped up Volvo. And this thing was really something. Other things we've had, stuff out of the 40s, 50s, 60s, modern Corvettes. And in fact, one time we even had one of the local Chevrolet dealers show up with a brand new one. That was pretty exciting. Yeah.
Well, anybody showing up with a really unusually customized or hopped-up car? I mean, something that is just eye-popping?
All kinds of stuff. Yeah. Friends of mine by the name of Choppet, a family out in Buena Park area, and brought out a beautiful kind of early 60s style custom customized Chevrolet coupe. So a lot of real neat stuff. And even if you don't have anything to show, it's fun thing to come and see. And you got your daily driver that's blends right in, bring it. Let's bless it.
Well, Monsignor Doug Cook, many thanks for joining us on the show today. And listeners, fire up your best rides and head down to Holy Family Cathedral this Saturday evening. Parking on the athletic field begins at 3, Mass is at 4, food and drinks are available from 5, and the blessing of the cars by Monsignor Doug begins at 6. So wax them up so the holy water beads up nicely, and be there or be square. Monsignor Doug, thanks again.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate the plug. Nice talking to you.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties, and AM 930 in Los Angeles County. I'm Patrick Mock.
Faustina, messenger of divine worship, comes to the Fried Theater on the Christ Cathedral campus beginning on August the 21st. This live, multimedia drama, performed by Maria Vargo and directed by Leonardo DeFilippis, is an amazing look into the spiritual life and strength of faith of St. Faustina. For tickets and more information, visit ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. That's ChristCathedralCalifornia.org.